All right, if you go ahead and turn to the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 19. Now, I don't relish the opportunity to teach special topic lessons because it's so hard to figure out what I want to teach. Like when I teach on a Sunday night, it's pretty hard because if I pick something kind of random like love or something like that, then people are going to go, "What? You got this one opportunity to teach us and you don't think we're very loving? Is that what it is? Is that what's happening here?" Well, when it comes to Easter, we can't just keep in our regular flow because y'all are different lessons. All right, you're staggered. Like on Wednesday, the junior high, you covered the triumphal entry. Well, high school, we won't get that until next Wednesday. So I was kind of racking my brain about what to teach. And I thought, you know what? I better look at what I did last year. And I noticed that last year I taught on, that's right, the importance of the resurrection from 1 Corinthians 15. And then I noticed I also taught that a few years before that on Easter. So I was like, whoa, okay, we're going to hold off on that one for a while. And then I kind of got the flow and saw what other people were teaching. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to teach about the cities of refuge in Deuteronomy 19. So that's actually my title, The Cities of Refuge. And we're going to look at the first 13 verses of Deuteronomy 19. And you might say, what does that have to do with Resurrection Sunday? What does that have to do with the risen Lord? Well, everything in the Bible has to do with the risen Lord. Is that a good enough answer? Everything before the cross being the culmination of history, everything before the cross is leading up to it, and everything after the cross is a result because of it. But I have a better reason than just that, and I'll get to it as we get into our outline. All right. Number one is the precept to prepare cities of refuge. The precept to prepare cities of refuge, which is basically a command. A precept is a command. They are commanded to prepare these cities. In chapter 19, it says, "When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God gives you, and you dispossess them and settle in their cities and in their houses, you shall set aside three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you to possess. You shall prepare the roads for yourself and divide into three parts the territory of your land, which the Lord your God will give you as a possession, so that any manslayer may flee there." Another difficult thing of jumping into a passage or jumping into a topic when you're teaching is putting it all into context. All right, the book of Deuteronomy, the theme of it is a second giving of the law. What's going on is the people are about to cross over from the wilderness into the promised land. All right, and we know that Moses has been leading them this whole time. Moses actually won't get to lead them into the promised land because of some things that he had done. Joshua is going to lead them over. So Moses is writing everything down again. And he's telling them everything again about what God wants for them. This is the second giving of the law. When they came out of Egypt, they were a people that had no structure as far as a government. All right, they had no ceremonial type of things. They had, some ceremony. They had no type of laws and restrictions and governing bodies and stuff like that. So when Moses takes them out of the wilderness by God's provision, he begins to give them rules and sets up things and do this and don't do that. And God says, build this and don't build that and all sorts of things like that. Well, then when they got to the point where they're about to enter into the promised land, they said, I trust you, God, no matter what, and I'll destroy anyone in my path because you told me I would. No, they sent some spies, and the spies came back and said, there's giants in there. We can't do that. God can't possibly beat them giants. And they go, oh, you're right, I'm scared. So God says, you're going to wander in the wilderness until this entire generation is dead. So they wander in the wilderness for how long? 40 years? Until that generation is dead, except for a couple of people that were faithful to the Lord. And here they are. Moses is about to leave them, and he is telling them everything again that they need to hear. So these cities of refuge, Moses has already told them. Moses has already recorded it, but he is doing it again for their benefit. these laws are establishing a nation. This is a huge thing. They're about to go into this land and they're supposed to destroy everybody. And they're supposed to take over their cities and they're supposed to set up their own nation and divide it out into different areas. And here is a key piece of the puzzle for how their country should be run. And the idea of a city of refuge is actually pretty foreign to us. We don't have cities of refuge, right? If we are in trouble and someone wants to kill us, we call 911, all right? That's kind of our refuge. We don't run to a specific place and say, ha-ha, you can't kill me, all right? We actually, it's kind of foreign to us because, I mean, anyone wanted to kill you lately? Okay, a couple of you. All right, but no one has actually tried to act out on that. But here's a scenario where someone really wants to kill someone else. And their only hope is to run, is to escape to one of these cities and have refuge there. The things that we want refuge from are, you know, a reprieve from homework, a refuge from the sun or something like that. We want a shelter above us. We want refuge from, you know, our family that we're going to see on Easter and things like that. This is a scenario where this person needs help. They need refuge. If they do not go to where God has told them to go, they will most likely be killed because of something that happened that was not their fault. They need refuge. So, there is a command, there is a precept to prepare cities of refuge. Now, there are already three cities of refuge on the other side of Jordan, but now they're going to cross over and they're supposed to establish new ones. All right. Number two on your outline, the purpose for preparing cities of refuge. The purpose for preparing these cities. And we're going to see that in verses 4 through 7. Now, this is the case of the manslayer who may flee there and live, when he kills his friend unintentionally, not hating him previously. As when a man goes into a forest with his friend to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down the tree, and the iron head slips off the handle, strikes his friend so that he dies. He may flee to one of these cities and live. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue the manslayer in the heat of his anger and overtake him, because the way is long, and take his life, though he was not deserving death, since he had not hated him previously. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall set aside three cities for yourself. Well, who would use these cities? They sound kind of cool, right? People are going to be living in daily business and whatnot, but who is going to really need these cities? Who's going to use them? There is a term in there. It's the manslayer. The manslayer. All right, the manslayer is the one, all right? And it's not just a dude who goes around hacking people and killing everybody inside. I am the manslayer. That's not quite what it's meaning, all right? It says, in the case of the manslayer who may flee there and live. This is someone who has unintentionally killed someone. It says, when he kills his friend unintentionally. Now, the key word is not so much friend. It could be friend or companion. It could be a stranger, but it is unintentionally. Like, you did not mean to do that. Like, if I walk over to Dan and I hit him in the head, that was not unintentional. That was to prove a point, all right? Unintentionally means accidentally. But it's also for someone going along with this, because it's unintentional, it is unpremeditated. It says, not hating him previously. Previously didn't hate this person. He didn't seek ill will towards this guy. He wasn't hoping that, hey, let's get this scenario together so that I can kill this person. Not hating him previously. It goes on to say, as when a man goes into the forest with his friend to cut wood. So we have a scenario. This, you go into the forest all the time and you cut wood, right? Going into the forest to cut wood. Maybe he had an old axe or a faulty axe or something along those lines. And his hand swings the axe to cut down the tree. And the iron head slips off the handle and strikes his friend so that he dies. That's a bummer, right? All right, you got a tree. They're going to go cut down the tree. And I go to cut the tree and the axe head slips off and... sorry, Dan is dead. All right? And then you look at it and you go, you all would, right? You wouldn't be like, ah, whatever, I get his candy. All right? You'd be sad, all right? This is a provision for, I didn't mean to do it. You didn't mean to do it. Whoever it wasn't intentional. It was not premeditated. It was unpremeditated. Think of the work day. We have the work day coming up. All right? Let's pretend that there are two youths that have rakes and they are sword fighting with these rakes. Not that it would ever happen. Except to Brendan. And They're playing with these rakes and they're having fun, and then what do you know? Something bad goes wrong and it stabs one of them and they die. If it was unintentional and premeditated, then that person would be innocent. That person would not be guilty. It would be an accident. All right? I want you to flip to Numbers 35. Numbers 35, because this tells us a little bit more about the cities of refuge. And remember, Numbers was written before Deuteronomy, but this is Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. And it goes into more detail. Look at verse 20. Let's go back to 16. No, 15. I like that. These cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel, for the alien, for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there. But if he did strike him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. If he struck him down with a stone in his hand by which he will die, as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him down with a wooden object in the hand by which he might die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him there. If he pushed him of hatred or threw something at him lying in wait, and as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or threw something at him without lying in wait, or with a deadly object of stone and without seeing it dropped on him, so that he died while he was not his enemy, nor seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. The congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger. The idea would be, if this is an unintentional, accidental, unpremeditated instance, then this person has protection. All right? So if you find yourself in a situation that you accidentally kill one of your friends, and you're living in Israel at this time, your best bet, the thing that you should do, is sprint to one of these cities. Leave everything behind. Go to one of these cities. Now, when I was growing up, I can give you an example of a premeditated thingamajiggy. I was sitting there and I was eating cookies, and my brother Matt, I'm the youngest and he's the second oldest, and I often sought refuge from them with my parents. But he was digging a ditch and he asked me for some cookies. All right? And somehow I ended up getting hit in the head with a shovel. And I have a stitch in my eyebrow. No, not the stitch from when I ran into the softball fence, and not the stitch from when the guy hit me in flag football, but the stitch from when my brother hit me in the head with a shovel. And if you were to go back on that scenario, all right, say my brother hits me and I die, he would run to this city and he would go there. But what you would find out is that he was guilty and he meant to do it, because I said, "You can't have any cookies," so he took a shovel and he hit me in the head. But that's not the story that he sold my parents, so that's the one that they bought, all right? The manslayer goes for protection. But why does he need protection? Why do we need this process? You might have picked up on a name or a title. It says the blood avenger. There is a blood avenger that is supposed to avenge the person who has died. Look at verse 6. All right? Verse 6. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue the manslayer in the heat of his anger. Now, there's a little bit of a debate on who the avenger is. That's kind of a cool one, right? The avenger of blood, the manslayer, stuff like that. Some would say that this is the closest family relative that needs to get down to business, all right? Colin and Kevin are out in the field, and Kevin accidentally kills Colin, so Aiden comes a knocking, all right? He's got to take care of Kevin because he is Colin's brother, or maybe his dad would show up or something like that, so Kevin would skedaddle to one of these cities of refuge, okay? It was a system that was put in place, right? Or it could mean the elders of that city. The elders of that city are the ones who are supposed to execute the justice, so they are the ones who would come, and they would be the avenger of blood. But you notice that they needed to establish a place of protection from the avenger of blood, but they also needed to establish usable escape routes. Verse 3 said, "You shall prepare the roads for yourself and divide into three parts of the territory of the land which the Lord your God will give you as a possession, so that any manslayer may flee there." Moving on to verse 6, it says, the avenger of blood might pursue him, the manslayer in the heat of his anger and overtake him because the way is long. He was telling them that not just setting up these cities, but you need to strategically set them up. You need to place them throughout the nation, and you need to make sure that there are roads prepared so that people can get there easily. All right? It would be a bummer if the city of refuge was in the state of Washington and you killed someone in Texas. All right? That is a long road. It is a long way to be able to get there. So they needed escapable routes. Eugene Merrill, in his commentary, said, "This is the second time in the book that such instructions appear. The first adding the specification that these cities be to the east of the Jordan, and it's in Deuteronomy 4. Numbers provides an even earlier listing of cities of refuge. There were three on one side of the river, and there are now to be three on the other side of the river. It's likely that the three cities of the Transjordan were already recognized as places of refuge by the time of Deuteronomy 19 was given. The cities that are going to be selected, Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron, would not need to be built from scratch, but would fall to the Israelites by conquest and be unscathed. Each would be centrally located within one of the three districts to which the land would be divided." So the good process they set up, all right? It'd also be needed to establish multiple places to find protection. Verse 7, "I command you, you shall set aside three cities for yourself." You got to set aside three. They got to be centrally located. There have to be good roads that are preserved for people to be able to go there. Okay? So number three on your outline, we have number one is the precept to prepare a city of refuge. Number two, the purpose for preparing cities of refuge. And now number three is the plan to prepare additional cities of refuge. And you're like, wow, this is a great Easter sermon. It ties in perfectly, right? We'll get there, all right? Just be patient. In verse 8, you see the promise to be kept. In verse 9, you see the condition to be met. And in verse 10, you see, if the condition is met, the promise is kept, and more cities are required. Verse 8, the promise to be kept. Verse 9, the condition to be met. In verse 10, if the condition is met, the promise is kept, and more cities are required. Look at verse 8. "If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as He has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which He promised to give your fathers." He said, you need to set up three cities, but if you obey the Lord and your things are going well, He is going to bless you. All right? He is promising that He is going to enlarge your nation. If that happens, you're going to have to set up additional ones. Verse 9, "If you carefully observe all this commandment which I command you today, to love your God and to walk in His ways always, then you shall add three more cities for yourself besides these three." Does anyone know where those additional three cities were located? They never happen. God promised this land to them, and He promised to give them all the land if they do what? There is a condition to it. If they love Him with all their heart, and if they walk in His ways, which we know that Israel never fully did that, so they never fully conquered all of the land, so they never needed these three additional cities. But just in case, God put that provision in there. And in verse 10, it says, "So innocent blood will not be shed in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, and blood guiltiness be on you." We'll get to this, but God is establishing all of this because He is a just God. He does not want the innocent to be punished. He wants the guilty to be punished. Number four on your outline is the prosecution of people abusing cities of refuge. The prosecution of people abusing cities of refuge. Now, someone tell me real quick, how would you abuse a city of refuge? Davis? Okay, maybe staying there too long? Hope? Yeah, if you're guilty. If you're actually guilty and you try to escape punishment by going to the city. All right? Verse 11 says, "But if there is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and rises up against him and strikes him so that he dies and he flees to one of these cities." Here we see if the one who flees is guilty. If in actuality the person who shows up at that city and says, "Hey, I need protection. City of Refuge, the manslayer laws, someone's after me. Blood Avenger's coming. And they welcome him in and they take that person in, but he's really guilty. He meant to do this. He hated his brother. Well, what's to happen to him? How is he to be prosecuted? Verse 12, then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood that he may die. The elders from where he was will come. They'll have a trial. They'll hear the testimony of witnesses. They'll decide whether he is guilty or not. And if he is found guilty, they will take him back. And who is supposed to kill him? The avenger of blood is supposed to kill him. If the one who flees is guilty, he is to be delivered over to the blood avenger. All right, one example of this. All right, it wasn't quite a city of refuge, but it's something similar. Remember a guy named Joab? Joab was a commander in David's army, and Joab killed a couple of different people. All right, Joab was not a righteous man. And at the end of his time, when Solomon is cleaning up all the loose ends from his father's kingdom, it's time for Joab to die. And so they go to get Joab, and Joab runs to the altar of God. All right, he didn't necessarily run to one of the cities. Right? He ran to the altar, and he's clinging to the altar. And he's using this idea of, you can't get me in here. All right, I am innocent. And they say, no, you're not. We're killing you. And they take him out and they kill him. All right. But why is this to be done? In verse 13, you learn that it's to be done for the good of the nation. You shall not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel, that it may go well with you. He's to be an example. He is to discourage other people from murdering, from killing people. It's to get rid of those types of people. All right. It's to make the nation, to make the land holy. It is for the good of the nation. So where do we go with this? How do we connect it? How do these apply to us today? All right, we're going to get to the conclusion part of your outline, but I don't want you to think, oh, sweet, we're done, because you're not. Because the conclusion won't be as long as the other part, but I have three different points to the conclusion. All right, and I want to flesh these out. When you look at this, when you look at the idea of the cities of refuge, I want you to see, number one, God's unceasing quest for justice. God's unceasing quest for justice. In this situation, you see that God wants to destroy the murderer, the guilty one, but He also goes through great lengths to preserve the life of the innocent. He is just. He is righteous. And in verse 13, it says, "You shall not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel, that it may go well with you." But then when you look at verses 14 through 20, we see another example of God's justice. All right, it's not quite the same scenario, but verse 14 it says, "You shall not move your neighbor's boundary mark, which the ancestors have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit the land that the Lord your God gives you to possess." All right, back then people didn't build big wooden fences around all their property. They would take stones, they would find a marker that was already there, and that's how they would divide up their land. All right, and they would say, you can't take the stones and move them over here, because that is unjust. All right, now God is concerned with how they handle murder. That's a good one, right? He is also considered, He is so just, He's considered about the smallest things, even the division of land. But He also puts in a process to help them in their decision making. It says, a single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity. So I can't say, oh man, Trey moved my boundary marker. And they say, really, he did? What's your proof? Well, I saw him. Well, how many are you? I'm one. Well, that's not enough. We need two of you. Or we need three of you to be able to do that. And it's a protection for the person that is accused. It says there need to be evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, so here we see that God's even just in the idea of someone who falsely accuses. He says if there is someone who's falsely accusing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who will be in office in those days. The judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, check this out, then you shall do to him just as he intended to do to his brother, thus you shall purge the evil from among you. So we go into a situation, and I say that it's Gage who killed Daniel. and I saw him kill Daniel. Then I present my case, but I was lying. It wasn't true. What would Gage's punishment have been if he had been found guilty? Death, right? So, as the false accuser, what should be my punishment? Death. That's how concerned God was with justice in His nation. It says in verse 20, "The rest will hear and will be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." You've heard this before, right? It's familiar to you. The whole eye for eye, tooth for tooth type of thing. He set this up in this nation so that people would behave. And so that there would be a deterrent, all right? Now, if you murder someone, you go to jail. The deterrent is jail. In certain states, they kill you, all right? That is the deterrent. Here, the deterrent is the same equal punishment, whatever happened, all right? Like if I got in a fight with Jordan, and Jordan punched me and knocked out one of my teeth, and we went before, and people were saying, yeah, Jordan was being mean, and he punched Justin and knocked out a tooth, what would they do? They'd probably be like, good job, man. No, they wouldn't. No, they would take out one of his teeth, make it even, make it fair, because God is consumed with justice. I want you to go to Deuteronomy 5. How else do we see that God has an unceasing quest for justice, for what is right? In Deuteronomy 5, He gives the Ten Commandments again. Verse 2, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, with all those alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face at the mountain from the midst of the fire, while I was standing between the Lord and you at that time to declare you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up to the mountain. He said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a what? A jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me." He is a vengeful God. He is a God that is holy, and He demands holiness from us, and He demanded holiness from Israel. And he says, if you break my law, you will be punished. You will be punished because He is consumed with justice. Sliding down to verse 17, you see the familiar command, "You shall not commit murder." Eugene Merrill says that so heinous a crime was murder that its penalty was to be inflicted without pity or compassion of any kind. The reason is that humankind is the image of God. Therefore, murder was deemed to be an assault on God Himself, the ultimate act of insubordination and rebellion. The shedding of innocent blood polluted the very ground and brought upon the community as a whole a culpability that could only be atoned for by the administration of the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth type of justice. Go back to verse 13. You shall show him what? No pity. Shouldn't be a sorrowful thing. You must destroy him because that is what God has commanded. So we have God's unceasing quest for justice. Now I want us to see number two, our unquestioned guilt. Our unquestioned guilt. You know where I'm going with this, right? The Sermon on the Mount. Jesus ratchets things up a bit. It's always been that way, but He was fully explaining what Deuteronomy 5:17 said when it says, "You shall not murder." He said that if you have angry thoughts in your heart towards someone, you're not even acting on those angry thoughts. You just have the angry thought towards someone. What is that? It's murder. It is murder. Because you might sit here to say, "I'm not guilty. I've never accidentally killed anyone. All right, and I for sure haven't premeditated the death of someone." But you, in fact, are a murderer. And I am a murderer because we have had hate in our heart towards someone else. Our guilt is unquestioned. If we stood in the courtroom of God, we would be convicted. The gavel would swing down and we would be declared guilty, guilty, guilty. 1 John 3:15 says, everyone who hates his brother is a what? A murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Every single one of us, we are a murderer. Deuteronomy 6:5 takes things up a notch. It says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Every single second of the day should be unquestioned love and devotion to God. Obeying Him perfectly, doing exactly what He wants. Abstaining from the things He says not to do, but doing the things that He says to do. And if you for one second don't follow Deuteronomy 6:5, you are guilty of the entire law. And as guilty of the entire law, you are deserving what? Death. You are deserving death. But we know that it goes much farther than that in our lives. Our whole life, we have actually looked at God's law and we've done the exact opposite. Obey your parents? No. Don't lie? No. Don't covet? No. Be nice and love? No. We are guilty before a holy and righteous God. And if you put number one and number two together, what do you get for number three? If you put God's unceasing quest for justice and you get our unquestioned guilt, I'm not very good at math, but it equals our utter hopelessness. Our utter hopelessness. Because if we were to escape to a city of refuge, what would they do to us? Let's pretend that in our scenario, we have all broken God's law, but God has set up a place where we can run to and get a trial before someone comes and kills us. If we ran to that place and they came and found us and they put us on trial, what would happen to us at the end? They would kill us. We're guilty. You ever lied? Yes. Dead. You ever disobeyed your parents? Yeah, you're dead. Do you ever be unloving towards someone? Yes, dead. Do you ever hate someone? Dead. Do you ever lust? Dead. Our utter hopelessness. There's no refuge, right? There's no refuge. Well, you can't hide from God. God is everywhere. God sees everything. Everything you've ever done, everything you've ever thought, everything you've ever wanted to do. God sees it. Our utter hopelessness. Except, that's not true, right? We're not hopeless. We have hope. So I want you to cross out our utter hopelessness. And instead, I want you to write our undeserved refuge. Our undeserved refuge. What happened to God's unceasing quest for justice? If God is fair, if God is just, shouldn't we be destroyed? We're not innocent here. It wasn't, oops, I sinned, just like the person accidentally killed the other person. We deliberately and maliciously disobey God and His Word. There's a refuge? This is where it all ties in. This is where it all ties in. Our refuge is the cross of Jesus Christ. Our only hope is that He died for us and in our place. And we must run to God. We must place our faith in Jesus Christ. That is our only hope to escape God's unceasing quest for justice. Sometimes when I catch Tucker or Tatum doing something wrong and I want to bring the hammer down, they'll do something funny and I just got to laugh and I can't do anything about it. Or they'll look at me and they'll be so cute and sweet and I can't do it, that little stinker. God doesn't work that way. He doesn't work that way. He doesn't look and say, oh, this cute person. You know, they're not that bad. Oh, look at what they... No, it doesn't work that way. God punishes. The wages of sin is death. That doesn't work with God. But I want us to take just a brief moment, and I want us to explore different offers of refuge that God has given. Different offers of refuge that God has given. And from those offers, we can learn something about God's offer for us. All right? Think of Noah. Noah, never rained before, told God, God said, I'm going to destroy the land, all right? I'm going to kill everybody in it, I want you to build an ark, I want you to get the animals, and I want you to put them in this ark that you know no one's ever seen a boat before. I want you to do that. This is your offer. What does Noah do? He takes it. God says, this is the only way. If Noah said, you know what, an ark, tells him exactly how to build it. Tells him exactly what he needed to do. And Noah said, yes, absolutely. And Noah went out and he told everyone else, come on, you're going to die for years and years and years. You're going to die if you don't get in this boat. And what'd they do? Yeah, right. They made fun of him. They mocked him. They kept living in their own wickedness. Think of Lot. Lot and his wife lived in the Sodom Gomorrah area. And an angel of the Lord came and told them that God is going to destroy this place. He's going to destroy this place with fire and brimstone. You need to go. And what does Lot do? He takes his family and he goes. He bails. He gets out of there. The angel says, if you stay here, you die. But there is refuge for you out there. And he goes. But he also said what? Don't even look back. Don't even look back. And what did his wife do? She looked back. Pillar of salt, just like that. She didn't fully trust in God. What about Jonah? There's two different stories in Jonah that deal with refuge. The men are on the boat and they're scared and the waves are crashing and all of these things. And Jonah says, the only way for you to be saved is to do what? Throw me in the water or else we all perish. And they hesitate. But finally they say, that's it, let's do it. And when they threw Jonah in the water, what happened? Everything calmed. And they praised God. They praised God because He had delivered them. They had reached the point they were so afraid they were going to die, they got their only way of escape and they took it. And then Jonah goes to Nineveh, a pagan, terrible, horrible place, and says, you're all going to die unless you repent. God offers you refuge if you will take it. And they go, yeah, sign me up for that. I repent. I'm wrong. I'm wicked. You see through this, that God's offer of refuge is always on whose terms? His terms. Why? Because He's the Creator and He is the owner of everything. With these cities of refuge, He says, there's three cities. You run to one of those. If you run to a different one, I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. You run to that city on My terms. He even says, reading on in Numbers 35, that if they were found innocent, the manslayer had to stay in that city until the high priest died. Had to stay there. And if he ever left the city, what would happen? The avenger of blood could come and kill him. Well, that doesn't sound fair. It doesn't matter if it sounds fair. It is God's terms. God's way, God's terms. Not only is it on His terms, it requires faith. It requires trust. So when we look at our unquestioned guilt before a God who has an unceasing quest for justice, we can only do it God's way. John 14:6, Jesus says what? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through Me. Acts 4:12, there is no one else, for there is no other name under heaven that has been given among men by which we must be saved. But why Jesus? Why only Jesus? Romans 6, for while we were helpless, while we were guilty, while we were to be condemned, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. One will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps the good man someone would dare even to die. But God demonstrates His own love toward us. And then while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having now been justified by His blood, we will be saved from the wrath of God through Him. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son, much more having been reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. Beauty. We deserve death. We should have lived the perfect life, but we didn't. We lived a sinful life. We deserve death. And Jesus comes and lives the life we should have lived. And He takes the punishment, the wrath of God on the cross. And then He rises again on the third day to defeat death and defeat sin. And He says, if you will believe upon Me, you will be saved. Your account will be clean. Be clean. And there's great blessings to enter into God's refuge. Complete forgiveness of sins. Eternal life with God the Father. Fellowship with Him now here on earth. relief, reprieve, joy, and peace from how painful this life is. Because come on, let's be honest with ourselves. This life is not fun. This life is not always joyous. It is heartbreaking. It is wearisome. It can be a beating. But Jesus said, come to me. Come to me and I will be your refuge. You deserve death, but I am offering you salvation. And if you have trusted in Jesus, today, like every day, is a day of celebration. He is risen. Our hope, our only refuge, isn't still in that grave. He's risen. And He's at the right hand of the Father. But if you have never trusted in Jesus, you are unquestionably guilty and you will be punished. God will show no pity on you. He will punish you unless you come to Him on His terms, that is repentance and faith. Well, as the music team comes forward, I want you guys one more time to sing that song, Look and See. All right, and as you do that, I want you to meditate upon the words. All right, it's a new song for some of you. Maybe you're a little bit nervous and shy about just singing out, but you can at least meditate on those words and the power. We have a great and glorious and awesome God who loves us, and we celebrate His gift of salvation. We celebrate the refuge that He gives us in Jesus Christ. So I'm going to ask Edwin and the music team to play this song, and after that, Edwin will close us in prayer.